All right. Well, if you've got your Bibles, we're going to 2 Samuel and trying to pick the pace up. We're doing two chapters this week. So we've got a little bit of a long reading, chapter 3 and 4, but the story fits together really well. Before I jump into it, I wanted to ask if you could also be praying for this afternoon is our annual board meeting, so just the board members, and we're preparing for what will be our church business meeting we do every year. Usually we do that in February, but my travel schedule is making it a little complicated, so it'll probably be sometime in the beginning of March, so I'll be getting out information on that to come. Nothing serious on the agenda, but we always take those times together. We take them seriously because we spend time talking about where we're going in the next year for the preaching schedule. We talk about any adjustments that need to happen to our budget or direction. We really try to get a sense for what God's doing and leading us. And so I wanted to ask you as we kind of prepare both for that meeting, but then also in March for a business meeting, something I haven't asked you to do before, but if you would, over the next couple of months, be in prayer about what it is you sense that God is doing in our church. And the thing I might ask, a little homework assignment, if I could give it to you to be as specific, is I would love to be able to hear what those prayers are and what you're sensing from God. So as you're praying over that, even in the next couple of weeks, if you would, two things I might give you to pray about. What do you value most about our church? So what is it that you sense that God is doing well here? And the other one is, where do you sense that it is God leading us over the next year, over the next couple of years? And I would love to hear your thoughts and prayers on that. You can get them to me in a variety of ways. You can email them or write them down and hand them to me on paper or text them to me. But those are really important. That's part of the process I go through as a pastor is trying to sense what God is doing. But I've never taken the approach that I'm the only one that can hear from God and what he's doing in this church. And the rest of you just hear from me and then follow, right? Some of you have given really wise wisdom and counsel in times past. And so I'm anxious to hear that. And I think it's a good process for you personally as well. Why does God have me in this church? And what is it that I sense God doing here? And where is God leading us? So a homework assignment, I don't ask that of you very often. But and I know, here's the thing too, all the ladies will do this. I'll get like 12 emails from the ladies tomorrow. And it's the men that I'll never hear from. So if I could be so bold as to say, which I realize the women all get like 30 pages. But I would be happy with a two-sentence text from any of the men as well. So.
I know where I'm starving.
Dan has plenty to say. I'm never worried about hearing from Dan.
My first text will be more respect from our senior pastor.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. We'll move on quickly so before I bog down. On to 2 Samuel. So for the last few weeks, we've been in a kind of mini-series starting off 2 Samuel. And we've been looking at this building conflict, this civil war that's broke out across Israel as men begin to jockey for position for the crown, access to the power. Today, we're looking at the longer passage, all of chapter 3 and chapter 4. But those chapters conclude what is this piece of conflict, David finally rising to king, as we'll see in chapter 5, and all of the conflict that's broke out in that time period as David waits patiently for that final ascension. We're only spending 3 weeks in this section, these four chapters, but it covers a pretty long period of time in David's life if you pay attention to the details of the chapters. You're going to see indications of it in the passage today. David has multiple children born during this time period. Years pass with Ishbosheth as the king of the north. The conflict between the house of David and the house of Saul drags on for years, as the passage tells us. What David faces in this civil war is a long, grueling, and trying time as he holds on to this promise of being king and finds the very people that he's supposed to be crowned over leading, disintegrating into conflict and bloodshed against their own people. What's been most characteristic about this time is this anger and manipulation, this attempt to seize power and control and manipulate who will be the next king. You might remember 2 Samuel opened with that story, and Amalekite coming into the camp, having killed Saul and rushed to David with Saul's crown, expecting to get a reward for it. Last week, we saw that grab for power turn inward as conflict broke out within Israel. Friendly, brotherly competition turns to blood, turns to war. Abner and Joab, these archetypal rivals that center that conflict. Abner and Joab will surface again in this chapter. But what I want you to pay close attention to as we read through these two chapters is this. Pay attention to God in the passage. Where does God show up? Who is talking about God? What are their motives when they start using God's name in all of these conversations? You might have heard the famous quote from Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. Someone asked him, or a reporter, whose side do you believe God is on? Is he on the side of the Union? And Abraham Lincoln supposedly responded, "My concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side." So I want you to pay particular attention to What side is God on in this story? And how do these men, in the middle of this civil war and this conflict, go about talking about God as they all desperately grab for power? What is God's side in Israel's civil war? And how well do Abner and Joab, Ishbosheth and David recognize the sides that they're taking? So let's read the passage again. A little bit of a longer one, but interesting stories as they've been so far in 2 Samuel. So we'll start in chapter 3 and read through chapter 4. So chapter 3, verse 1. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel, and his second, Chileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. And the fifth, Shephatai, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. You'll remember this is the battle-hardened general that had served under Saul and now propped up Ishbosheth we met last week. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hands of David, and yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman? God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba." And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. And Abner sent messages to David on behalf, saying, "To whom does this land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you." And he said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you. That is, you shall not see my face unless you bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bride's price, 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Barum. I can let it read. It might get these names better than I'm doing too. So when I get to some of these, we'll just let it read. So then Abner said to him, "Go return." And he returned. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, "For some time past, you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about. For the Lord has promised David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" Abner also spoke to Benjamin. And then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, "I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, and they will make a covenant with you, that you may reign over all their heart desires." So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Just then the servant of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told to Joab, "Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace." Then Joab went to his king and said, "What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you and to know your going out and your coming in and to know all that you are doing." When Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah, but David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, "I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. And may the house of Joab never be without one who is has a discharge, or one who is leprous, or holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle of Gibeon. Then David said to Joab, to all the people who are with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. The king David followed the bier. They buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen. And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. But David swore, saying, God, do so to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased him, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner, the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zerah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evil doing, the evil according to his wickedness. Chapter 4, it's shorter than chapter 3. When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of the one was Baanah, and the name of the other was Rechab, sons of Rimmon, the man of Benjamin from Bereath. For Bereath also is counted as a part of Benjamin. The Bereathites fled to Gittim and have been sojourners there to this day. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. That's a strange paragraph stuck in the middle of this story. We're not going to spend time on it today, but it's going to be important. We're going to come back to this one, so remember it's here. Verse 5. Now the sons of Rimmon, of Bereathite, Rechem, and Baanah, set out, and about the heat of the day they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baanah, his brothers, escaped. When they came into the house, as he laid on his bed in the bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of the Arabah all night and brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and on his offspring. But David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, the Betharite, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? And David commanded his young men, and they killed them, and cut off their hands and feet, and hung them outside the pool of Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. That's a long passage. More than being a long passage, it's also a mess. I don't know if you picked that up from reading this story, but it's a whole lot of death, a whole lot of killings. You read the passage, and it's full of all of the sort of strange things: betrayal and deception, manipulation, assassination, politics, bartering over the lives of women and concubines, trials and judgments, death sentences, and extreme executions. The whole thing reads a little bit like an ancient HBO miniseries, as everyone tries to jockey for position on power, and everything turns more and more violent in the process. In the middle of this hurricane of violence and politics stands this character, David, our main character in these stories. But David isn't given the luxury of reading this story with 3,000 years of distance like you and I are. David finds himself at the center of these violent winds cutting constantly in opposite directions across him. David wakes up each morning into the reality of a nation at war with itself. His own men, driven by radical and unforgiving passion for vengeance and violence against the very people that David wishes to win over to rule. There are no pure motives, no good guys, no bad guys in this story. These are all his people. These are all Israelites, brothers to one another. He has supposedly already long ago been crowned king, David, king over Israel, this whole mess, this whole civil war. But just as much lawlessness keeps showing up, just as much hatred and violence in David's own house, his own camp, as across the valley and across enemy lines. Everywhere David turns, he finds men turning on one another, these men, all Israelites, who he had been called to lead, to rule over. For years, David must have stepped out on the balcony of his home in Hebron. Sure, he had been crowned king of his own people, Judah. But a decade before, Samuel had anointed him king over all Israel. As he looked northward to the rest of Israel, the sun rising and casting light on the hills above him, what lay on the horizon were those people, his people, brothers and sisters, those who he had been anointed to lead and to serve, to lead for God. But tucked away in every one of those towns on the horizon were men plotting to kill him. Israelites forming armies and conspiring to bring down David's line, David's house. Politicians standing in town squares, ranting against David and against David's power. What must David's heart have felt, fighting the very people day in and day out that he had for so long, for decades, dreamed of serving and leading? How could any of this be God's doing? How could any of this be in God's plan when he had anointed David and called David king of Israel? How desperate David must have found himself day in and day out over all these years to be done with it. We're going to walk back through that story in a minute, but before I do, I want to draw your attention to what for David must have been a startling tension in all of this violence. David lived with an ideal promise, a hope, an image he had of being king, of a united Israel. He was king not just of his family, Judah, but all of Israel. He was king of a united Israel, and at this particular moment, that united Israel simply didn't exist. What David held on to, what he hoped for, what he saw in himself as a future, wasn't very much a part of the reality that he looked out on and lived in day out. There was no Israel at this time, just two warring parties constantly at conflict with one another. But David hangs on to this ideal. He clings by faith to what he had received long ago and still believed was coming by God's will. It was a hope, an image of his own people, united not just around this throne, but around God and God's leading through David. So David lived seeing more than what his political advisors or his military advisors could have possibly recognized as they fought and tried to bring an end to this civil war. Joshua Chamberlain was a literary professor who became one of the great generals of the American Civil War, and he said this about the holding on to ideals. It is something great and greatening to cherish an ideal, to act in the light of a truth that is far away and far above, to set aside the near advantage, the momentary pleasure, the snatching of seeming good to self, and to act for remoter ends, for higher good, and for interests other than our own. It's true of David, but one of my fears in preaching through these stories of David, and I've seen it happening even in the last few weeks as you and I talk about David afterwards, is that these stories about David end up leaving you with a kind of idealistic image of who David was. David has an idealistic vision. He has an ideal, a perfect image that he holds on to by faith. But the man David lives in far too complicated of times to be idealistic himself. What he hopes by faith to accomplish is good, but by this point in the story, it's hard to see David as perfect. We begin in this passage to see that image break down. David isn't presented as some desert monk who withdraws himself from all of this conflict into quiet prayer and solitude to avoid the difficulties. David doesn't walk through the crowds with some pure white robe and a glowing halo hung over his head so everyone recognizes that he's the good guy in this story, perfect in everything that he does and says. All of these prayers that he prays, they're not just poetic and perfect, they're also full of real humanity, difficulties and strugglings, trying to understand and sense what God is doing. What emerges from this story is the realization that David is a part of this mess. He finds himself in the very middle of it, and there's no way for him, no luxury to escape it. David has no luxury to distance or separate himself from it. This is where God has led David, into the middle of this chaos, and this is the very place that David is called to have faith, to wait and watch as God makes him king. There are battles that David must fight, decisions that David must make, a territory that needs to be ruled and protected. He has men to lead. Men like Joab, who are difficult to lead and constantly doing their own thing. A family David has, the complexity of multiple wives, which we'll touch on again in a little bit, that'll become a part of David's story. But David picks up something new from this passage we haven't seen in David's story before. This shiny image of David finally begins to show signs of tarnish. The fingerprints of humanity, the difficulty of a civil war, conflict turns even this glistening bronze image of David green, and the corrosion begins to form around the edges. I point this out because I think it's important in David's story, we're going to see it in more detail as we move on, to understand the Bible is not an idealistic book. The stories that it offers us are not simple and perfect and ideological. It's not an encyclopedia of Hallmark quotes, principles, or motivational speeches that you can memorize and put into perfect application every time a difficulty arises. The Bible is not full of ideal people. It's hard to work through this Bible and walk away with images of anyone as the true hero, maybe apart from Christ. Perfect leaders, perfect disciples, perfect people, perfect hopes is not what this Bible is made of. There is nothing in these two chapters, if you were honest in reading it, that looks perfect. The whole thing is an absolute mess that turns bloody on every page. Not even David escapes these stories looking perfect. If you read these chapters, you can pick up advice, but you'll stretch yourself to really understand how that advice can be put into perfect practice. So much of what we read here is difficult to apply. Difficult because it looks like the same chaotic mess that most of us wake up to. This is what you're given in these stories. God will use this context, this complicated mess, to work, to bring about David as king. And this is what's so surprising about the Bible. God is not embarrassed to use such contexts at the center of his story. It's through the people of Israel, it's through the difficulties of these stories and these contexts that God does his work, holy and good work of salvation, set down in the midst of complicated mess. God isn't above being used in places like this. This is the place where David has been led to, and this is the place where David is called to follow. Chapter 3 and 4 are made up of really three main stories. The first one we saw was Abner, the kingmaker, the cousin of Saul, turns on his own man, Ishbosheth, and decides to cross lines and join David in a peace deal. The second story is Joab, angered by this news, murders Abner after David had negotiated peace with him. The third story, with Abner dead and Ishbosheth vulnerable, two assassins kill Ishbosheth and bring David his head. Imagine you're David at the center of this story. Try uniting this nation under your leadership when everybody that you trust and every conversation that you had ends up falling through, turning in betrayal, falling apart in assassination. This is the Israel that David is attempting to lead, attempting to become king of. In the first story, Abner is confronted by the king, Ishbosheth, for taking one of Saul's concubines. It's a complicated piece. We don't have time to deal with every bit of the story, but there's a lot going on. It was common in the ancient world for a king, as you've sort of already seen forming, but even outside of Israel, to take multiple wives and concubines for several reasons. One of the reasons it's so common is kings were especially concerned with having enough children that there would be a main descendant that they could pass the crown down to. As you know, in the ancient world, just because a child was born did not guarantee that that child would live into adulthood. So oftentimes, kings built as big of families as possible as a kind of insurance, just to make sure there were at least some strong males that they could pass the crown down to. There were also often political reasons for marrying. Marriage would be used to form alliances or seal political deals, as we actually see in this story as well. So kings would accumulate brides as they negotiated peace with enemies. There's also a third one. There's this image of king in the ancient world as being the husband of their people. So the king functioned as a kind of caretaker, a husband for the entire nation. So often kings, to kind of build up the PR of that image, would build large households as a representation of their role for caring for the people. Maybe you can question that motive a little bit. It sounds like good PR. But anyways, in the ancient world, that was one of the ideas. They were the image of caring for the people, so they built big houses to show it. What Ishbosheth accuses Abner of doing is taking one of these wives, these concubines, for himself out of the royal household. In other words, he's taking, possessing, stealing one of the king's possessions, a direct threat to the throne and the image of Saul's house before the people. Abner had made Ishbosheth king, but Ishbosheth now confronts Abner about taking too much, putting his hands on too much. And Abner's not happy about the confrontation. Abner points out that he has been faithful to Saul's house when everyone else was willing to walk away from Ishbosheth. He uses the interesting phrase, "And now you think I'm a dog's head of Judah." What in the world is a dog's head of Judah? He's basically saying, you now act like I'm some wandering stray dog from the enemy's camp who's out looking for a mate in your house. Abner then says something pretty shocking. Look at verse 9, chapter 3. He makes a covenant before God. "God, do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba." Abner explains, right to Ishbosheth's face, the king, that he's switching sides, that God should destroy him if he doesn't see through handing over all of Israel to David instead of Ishbosheth. And what is Ishbosheth, who's just sparked this conversation, what is his response? Ishbosheth could not answer another word because he feared Abner. And so Abner does just that. He goes to David, he negotiates peace, he offers to lead all of the other tribes, including Saul's home tribe of Benjamin, over to David. He can convince them to follow David. And David agrees, peace is struck, negotiated. David's only request is that his first wife, Michal, you might remember, which was Saul's daughter, that he had lost whenever he was forced to flee into the wilderness. David's only request is that that first wife be returned to him. On those grounds, peace would be struck in Israel. Next, we find out that Joab, remember this arch-rival of Abner, returning home, hears that David has dealt peace with Abner, and it immediately infuriates him. How could you trust someone like Abner? So what does Joab do? He calls Abner back without David's knowledge. Abner must have been returning, assuming that Joab was negotiating or working out further details. But as Abner returns, Joab takes him to the side in private at the city gate and assassinates him, murders him. David actually manages to swing that complicated situation to a right way. He punishes Joab and his brother by humiliating them, forcing them to walk publicly in shame at the funeral procession. He laments publicly and fasts over Abner's death. And even David's enemies become impressed at the reverence that David was willing to show to Abner. But with Abner dead, the third story, Ishbosheth finds himself vulnerable, without political protection. Two of Ishbosheth's own guards, who have access to his bedroom, turn on him and murder him in his sleep. They bring his head to David, expecting a reward for having knocked off the rival king. And like David had done with the Amalekite that brought Saul's crown, David has them executed for the assassination. This is where I need to get a little bit technical. I promise there'll be a point. Every once in a while, I have to pull out, like, I went to seminary and Bible college, and I paid this money, so let me use some of it here. So it's a little technical, but an important point. What's going on in 2 Samuel chapters 1 through 4, these stories of civil war, is a thing called chiastic structure. It's a literary technique that's pretty common, and we've seen it many times before. I just haven't pointed it out. It's one of the primary ways that the Israelite storytellers would build narratives. The idea would be something like this. The Israelites would use mirror images of stories on either ends of it to work back towards a central point. So we've got four chapters we're looking at, chapter 1 and chapter 4. Those end stories would mirror each other. And then as you step in, chapter 2 and chapter 3, those stories would mirror each other. And at the very center, you would get a story that's kind of the main point of this entire story being built around it. So maybe imagine two funnels. One of them is coming into a point. The other is coming out from a point. These stories mirror each other. These funnels mirror each other. I can show it to you in the passage. In the first chapter, we had an Amalekite who comes having killed Saul, taken his crown, and expects a reward for it, and then is instead executed by David. The beginning of the story. Now jump to this end of this story, chapter 4. Two men come into David's camp having killed Ishbosheth, which is Saul's son, and carrying his head expecting a reward for it, and they're executed. You see the parallels, the sort of bookends on the end? So step in one story from it. You step in one story from the beginning, and what you have in chapter 2 is conflict breaking out between Abner and Joab. We saw it last week, the competition that turns violent. Step in from the other end, what do you have? You have Abner and Joab in conflict at the city gate, and Joab reaching his hand out and striking him down out of vengeance and anger for his killed brother. You see the conflict, the parallels of these stories. Step in one more time, and what do you have at the center of these four chapters? You have this fascinating conversation between Abner and Ishbosheth. And what's strange about that conversation is Abner surprisingly turns on his own king. What's the real shock of that story? Well, it's Abner's words, "I will accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him." You have this image of a proud and capable man, battle-hardened man, a politically opportunistic man, promising to make God's promise come true. A really interesting statement. You have him doing it out of spite, out of hatred for Ishbosheth. Apparently he had known, Abner, that God had promised David the throne a long time ago, but that had never stopped Abner from working against David, working against God's promise. But in this moment, politically motivated, he decides to switch and boldly makes this declaration, I will accomplish God's promise to David. That motivation is not just true. The reason it's at the center point of this story for Abner, it's true for so much of what motivates these characters and what moves this drama, this civil war, through all four chapters. This is the motive that has started the whole mess, the conflict. Men seeking to accomplish for themselves what they tell themselves God is doing. Men taking action to make happen what they've been waiting and trusting God to do. Earlier I asked you when we read through that passage to pay attention to where God comes up in these stories. What you found, if you did pay attention, is that there's no obvious miracle in any of these four chapters. There's nothing you could point to as a miraculous appearance of angels or signs and wonders to lead men in the direction of what God is doing. There's not much you can point to and say, there is God as a character showing up in the story. David must have felt that absence particularly through all of these years. But even though God doesn't appear as a character, there's plenty of God talk through all four chapters. Abner, in anger and rage, speaks the motive most honestly, I'll do for David what God has promised. But it shows up in other places. You see it in Abner's words to David when he comes to negotiate peace. To whom does this land belong? He says. Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you. To who did the land belong is a pretty arrogant statement. It's Abner's way of saying, don't you realize I'm the one that controls the outcome? I'm the one who has control of Israel in this land. Abner says and suggests that the real covenant David needs to make is with him. He's the one with control and power. Or listen to what Abner says to the Israelite tribes. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, for some time past you've been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about, for the Lord has promised David. In other words, he says to Israel, you go ahead and bring about God's promises. Now the time, with this political speech that I'm giving you, this motivation and clearance, you go ahead and act in God's promises that you've been waiting for. Or listen to the words of the two assassins who show up with Ishbosheth's head as they come to David. They brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron, and they said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and on his offspring. The Lord has avenged you, as these two men stand, assassins holding the head. They assassinate Ishbosheth and associate their work, their action, with God's. The Lord has avenged my Lord. What these chapters give you is actually a pretty major theme in the Bible if you pay attention to it. We have a bad habit, us humans, especially caught in complicated times, of assuming what God is doing and taking actions to make it happen for ourselves. And usually, we're rarely aware or honest enough to acknowledge our own real motives. Think about it this way through the Bible. Abraham got tired of waiting for a son, waiting on the promise, and so what did he do? He conceived a plan to have a son with one of his slaves, which opened up a whole storyline, a whole human history of conflict. Joseph had been promised that one day his brothers would bow down to him, so what does he do? He runs around holding it over his brothers, taunting his brothers with it, and acting like they ought to already be bowing down to him. Or Moses, finally, the prince of Egypt in the palace of Pharaoh, saw the need of his own people, went out and looked upon his brothers and realized their need for deliverance. And what does he do? He reaches out and strikes down one of the Egyptian overseers to kick things off. And his own people respond, who made you king over us? Israel got tired of waiting on Moses while Moses was taking too long on the top of the mountain with God, so they talked Aaron into making a gold calf so they could get on with worshiping. Make no mistake, this is David's great temptation, David's trial of these years. Can David wait for God, wait for what God had promised, without trying to make it happen by his own means, his own politics, his own power, his own manipulation? The real question, the test of David in these chapters, is can David have patience? That's a word that's been coming up a lot around my house lately. Patience is not something I've learned that we develop naturally as human beings and children. Spend an afternoon with a crying infant or with a toddler who's hyped up on too much sugar from grandma and grandpa's house, and you'll find out that no one likes waiting. This is not something that comes naturally to us. I'll say to Will multiple times a day, remember that hard word that we've been talking about lately? Patience. Patience. Waiting for something. Tolstoy, the great Christian Russian novelist, who wrote the book War and Peace, it's one of the probably the best, greatest war novels in history. He writes this at one point. The strongest of all warriors are these two, time and patience. What Tolstoy is suggesting is that for warriors, men of action who pride themselves on making their own way, charting their own course, they are the ones most often beaten by the greatest warrior, having to wait, having not to act, but having instead patience and the passing of time. We struggle with patience because we feel like nothing is happening. How David must have felt this day in and day out, battle after battle, as he saw the very nation he hoped to lead disintegrating and falling apart into deeper and deeper conflict. Wasted time. David was getting older as he waited to become king. How much better a king he might have imagined he would have been with all of the energy of his 20s and 30s and 40s, but now, what good would it be to finally become king as an old man? Wouldn't David have been better than these wasted years of Ishbosheth? Why go on waiting? We know the feeling. We get desperate. Like gold miners, we start sifting through every moment and every detail of our life, desperately looking for any opportunity, any advantage, a chance that we can get things going or find something in our lives we can use to make it happen. Like Abner, everything in our life gets sifted to find advantages, advantages that give us control, advantages that left Abner feeling in charge, the one who had the land, the one who could deliver what God had promised. When our sifting uncovers what appears to be gold, a rare opportunity, a momentary advantage, an open window that we think is just what we need, we take action immediately, blessing it as God's plan and imagining that this is finally the fulfillment of everything we've been waiting for. And too often we discover that it's fool's gold, not what God had actually been doing, but our own desperation, working anything and everything into fulfilling it for ourselves. Here's what I want you to see. The goal we imagine we are so desperately waiting for, the crown that David is hoping for, the dreams that you wait on, the desires that you're constantly patient to see. Those things, their individual fulfillment, is not what is often most important to God. Everyone in Israel was obsessed with a crown, with who would be king and their proximity to that power. David must have prayed it 100 times. When will I be king? When will your promises become true? When will I rule and sit on the throne? When will you unite Israel under me? When do you want me to seize the opportunity and take Israel for myself? But God's interests were not just in making David king. Kings, it turns out from the story, are pretty easily made. All they need is a crown, a cast piece of metal, and a proclamation of a title. King. Ishbosheth. King of Israel. Kings come and go. Look at Ishbosheth. Look at Saul. What's really at stake in this story is not the title, not the crown. More important is not that David become king, the title of king, but this title that David has had since early on. A man after God's own heart. God wasn't looking for a king nearly as much as he was looking for a particular kind of man. God was looking for someone who knew how to follow him, someone who knew how to wait, someone who understood patience. Only that kind of person could be truly be God's chosen king for God's people. I always get made fun of when I use Lord of the Ring or Star Wars references, but I'm going to do it anyway. So if you've seen the Lord of the Ring movies or read any of the books, you remember Tolkien, who wrote the original books, was a devout Christian. Although he doesn't claim that the books Lord of the Ring are Christian books, he often talked about the fact, how could they not be Christian themes, Christian stories flowing out of his deepest beliefs? The Lord of the Rings is really striking on this point about the true kind of king. You'll remember the storyline to the Lord of the Rings is that there's a ring to rule all rings. Whoever possesses this ring is given access to an immense amount of power. But that ring, the ring to rule all rings, had been created by an evil lord. And many men tried to seize the ring and use it for good, even to defeat this evil lord, to overthrow evil. But they always ended up worse than the ruler who had created it. Possessing the ring, trying to use the ring for good, always ended up bringing out the worst in them, the most evil. The evil just kept going. The point of the story is the ring can't be ruled. Its power can't be controlled. It can only be destroyed, or it will destroy. Those are the two options. No one can destroy the ring because its potential power seizes everyone who picks it up. It controls them. The temptation becomes too great, and they use the power for the very same evil that they hope to overcome by it. The reason the story centers around this little character, Frodo, this little hobbit who doesn't seem to be worth much, why he's the hero, he's the only one who can carry that ring in his pocket without giving in to it, without trying to use it, without it turning him, without taking it and possessing it. His strength, what makes Frodo a hero in the story, is not his power, it's not his heroics, it's not his conquests in battle. What makes Frodo the hero of The Lord of the Rings is patience. Frodo conquers evil not with power, but sacrifice, long-suffering, a refusal to take for himself, but the patience of carrying that ring, that potential power in his pocket, without ever actually using it. The King James Version often translates this word patience, like in places like the fruit of the Spirit. It often translates that Greek word as long-suffering. Patience. Long-suffering. Frodo's patience is his ability to withstand long periods of suffering, ambiguity, uncertainty, to keep moving forward without feeling the need to manipulate it or use the power that resides in his pocket, to bear continually the tension, and to never use it or manipulate it for his own advantage. You might remember how Saul, the first king of Israel, lost his power, God's favor. He was impatient and waiting for Samuel to show up and make the sacrifice before the great battle. He rushed ahead and made the sacrifice himself, not wanting to wait for Samuel. What's true of Frodo turns out to be true of David too. If now David were to seize the throne by the same tactics, the same impatience that Saul used in losing the throne, what would David have gained? A crown, a moment of power. But in the end, he wouldn't truly be the king that God had called him to be. Evil used to replace evil accomplishes nothing. David must wait, must suffer long, must have patience to see God bring about what only God can work. Otherwise, David runs the risk of being the very thing that he hopes to conquer. I think the point of this story that's so important is the reality all of us have things we're waiting for. Some of you have shared them with me. Things that you've been patiently waiting and praying for a long time. Others of you, I know, get frustrated because you keep acting and trying to make things happen, thinking time and time again it's God, only to be further frustrated by things not working out. And some of us are just completely confused to anything that's going on and clueless on what next step to take. Listen to what Martin Luther says about all of this patient waiting that so much of us practice in life. "Those speak foolishly who ascribe their anger or their impatience to those who offend them or to tribulation. Tribulation does not make people impatient, but proves that they are impatient. So everyone may learn from tribulation how his own heart is constituted." I don't know if you catch that. If you're having trouble waiting, Luther says, that trouble waiting is not causing your impatience. It only proves that what is in your heart is impatience. You learn from your waiting what's really important to you, what you really want, what you're really waiting for. Your impatience only proves that your heart is still fighting for control, still desperate, still wanting something and wanting it now on your terms. David was forced to deal with that every time there was a window of opportunity before him. What is really motivating me in this moment to take action? What am I really hoping for? Why do I feel anxious? Is this me or is this really God? Because here's the most important point of these chapters, the first four chapters of 2 Samuel. If you remember nothing else about chiastic structure, remember at least this point. Oftentimes, we are made to wait because our heart is not fully ready to receive. Some things God has promised you, you aren't ready to receive and to fully enjoy in your life until you're no longer so desperately in need of them. Let me say that one more time. Some of the things that God has promised you, you aren't really ready to receive or fully enjoy until you no longer so desperately need them. David will only be a true king when he isn't desperate to be king. Don't you see that's the only way out of all of this mess, all of this conflict, and all of this violence? Someone who's willing to step into the middle of it and simply say, "I don't need to make my own way. I don't need to use these people around me. I'm not here to manipulate lives or situations, but to sense what God is doing. It's the one thing that no one else in this story is able to do. To give up the angling, to give up the manipulation, to lay down a life and simply trust through long-suffering God is at work. I don't think I need to point out the connections of the one character in this Bible story who does just that, who makes a way through the mess, long-suffering. C.S. Lewis makes this point in Mere Christianity. Nothing you have not given away will ever truly be yours. Nothing that you're not ready to willingly give away will ever truly be your possession. It may be that when you are no longer desperate for something, you finally come to the place of being able to receive it rightly. Is that not what Jesus was trying to say when he said, a man must lose his life in order to find it? A man must be willing to let go of his life in order to possess it again. Is this not the patience of faith for all salvation, that only when I have nothing to offer before God, not expecting, earning, or manipulating anything before him, am I finally free to receive grace, to finally recognize what it is God is offering me and all of its full reward? Let me wrap up with this. Make no mistake, this is difficult and complicated work. This kind of patience, this kind of testing of my heart to let go so that I might finally be able to receive. A bit of the painful foreshadowing in this story that works itself out is what makes it so difficult. You probably didn't notice it the first time you read the story, but there's stuff going on here that clues us in to even David's difficulty in practicing this kind of patience. While in Hebron, David had taken six wives. I don't know if you noticed that at the beginning of the story. Those six wives had borne him six different children. Before you too quickly chalk this all up to typical David and his constant interest in women, we're given all the places that those wives came from, and the realization is that most of them are from enemies or prominent families, outsiders. Most of these marriages appear to be political. David is managing peace, negotiating peace through marriage, bearing children to hope to pass on his throne. You can't miss him doing it, bartering for Michal, the daughter of Saul, to bring about peace in Israel. Surely David must have imagined that had he had his wife back, Saul's own daughter, it might have healed some of those wounds between the house of Saul and the house of David. But you also can't miss the tragic scene. Michal had remarried since David had left, and as she is ripped out of the relationship, her husband follows behind in tears, having lost his wife, seized in political angling by David. How can you miss the foreshadowing of what's to come in David's life as David would again seize another man's wife? You remember Michal, Saul's daughter, from earlier stories. You see through in this moment a side of David that struggles to wait, that struggles with patience. As David begins to work out through marriage and negotiations, negotiated peace. David had neglected the advice of Moses in Deuteronomy when Moses had warned future kings, "You shall not acquire many wives for yourself, lest your heart be turned away." Even David had cut deals and bartered for lives to negotiate peace. And as Moses had predicted, the desire to make things happen for ourselves always obscures and leads our heart away. When we find ourselves desperate to make our own angles work, desperate to do for God, to make God's promises come true for ourselves, constantly sifting through every life, every moment, every piece around us for what we can get from it and how we can use it, the one thing it always does is turn our hearts away from God. It makes our own hearts difficult to understand. It hides within our own hearts our true motives. And in the end, it leads us away from God, from faith. A desperation to work out the promises always turn hearts away from the real joy, away from the real promise of receiving what God has in store. Patience that reveals your heart, that examines your true need, is never ever wasted time. I think that's the ultimate point of this story for David. Years of civil war, years of conflict, if out of it comes a realization of what he truly wants, his heart's greatest need, then none of this is actually lost. None of this time is wasted. Because to know the heart and for that heart to turn to its greatest, truest need is the most valuable use of any time, any amount of patience, and any amount of waiting. Let's close in prayer and we're going to worship. Heavenly Father, we come before you today acknowledging that patience is hard for us. God, I know personally so many of us in this room have things we are waiting for. Prayers that we've been praying for years, situations we're desperate to see resolve, hopes and dreams that we continue to cling to even though there's not much evidence of it happening around us. God, we see from all of these men and women in this story, and even David, who we've had so much hope for, even in his own difficulties with patience, we begin to recognize our own heart's tendency. God, our tendency is to make our own way, to make things happen for ourselves, to manipulate an angle, to try to get things moving, to make your promises fulfill themselves by our own hands. And God, we recognize in these stories that when we do that, God, so much is lost. We use people, we use situations, we lose perspective on you and on our own heart's desires. God, we inherit messes of life just like David does, complicated situations we find ourselves in. And so we pray this morning, God, that you would just uncover our hearts, that through this suffering, this long suffering and waiting, God, you might begin to reveal to us our true needs. That as we wait, God, you might begin to clean out our hearts and bring about a true desire, a deeper desire for you. This desire of salvation, God, that we would have nothing in our hands, but we would come before you laying down our power, laying down our crowns, and that we would receive from you not as a reward, not as our work, but grace freely given, God. And that as we receive that grace, you might begin to work it in our heart for all other needs. That God, everything before us, we might begin to treat with this same patience. What you give us, we need. Anything else, we're willing to forfeit, to have you and to see what you're doing in our heart and in our lives. We know that's not easy work. It wasn't easy for David. It gets clouded in so many of these stories. So we depend on you, God. We depend on your Spirit to reveal to us through this waiting our own lives and our own hearts. We do that this morning by faith through worship, trusting you, patiently waiting, believing that what you do in your time is better than anything we could manufacture or make for ourselves. Letting go of even what we think we need so we might be able to finally receive the good that you have planned, that you have in store for us. And God, the real truth of all salvation, that when we lose our life, when we set aside what we desperately need, God, you don't just save us, but you pour life abundantly back into us. You give us the riches of our heart. You give us all of our greatest desires in ways greater than we ever could have asked for or comprehended on our own. So by faith this morning, we lay it down. We give you our desperate needs. We give you the needs that we wait for patiently. And we say, God, whatever your time, whatever it is you have in store, God, we want it, what you're doing. Let us express that to you today in these songs that we sing, God. It's in your name we pray. Amen. Stand.